There could be no image more tragic. A teddy bear suspended in a black background, the arms flung apart and tenuously hanging onto the body. The fur left only in tufts around the parts least loved. One paw, the chin. It's a bear, a lost bear. And the story of this image is one never to forget. The image is part of an exhibition of objects from the Nazi concentration camps of Sachsenhausen and Ravensbrück. About to be shown in Sydney, this exhibition, and then touring around the world. And here to tell that story is the Sydney-based photographer Richard Weisel, who made these images and was given unique access to the closed archives of the two camps. Richard, welcome to the art show. And can we start by you telling the story of that teddy bear?
Hey, Eddie, thanks for having me. That bear belonged to a very small child, a four-year-old Romanian Sinti boy that arrived into Ravensbrück, the women's camp, which is about 90 minutes north of Berlin, on a transport from Romania, Hungary. And he was carrying that bear with him. And as he was walking in line and trying to keep up with the adults in the line, he actually dropped his teddy bear. And as he went back to pick it up, an SS guard saw him step out of line and basically clubbed him to death with the back of his rifle. A political prisoner called Annie Sinderman, who was on the same transport, witnessed this, picked up the teddy bear, hid it, and kept it for the remainder of her time at Ravensbrück. And only after the war did she continue to talk about her experience in the camp and then share this teddy bear with anyone and everyone that would listen. And on her death around 1988, she donated that teddy bear to the archives of Ravensbrück concentration camp in memory of that little boy and her time at the camp. And, you know, to me, I photographed probably 80 images, 80 artifacts, personal objects at both Ravensbrück and Sachsenhausen. And that, to me, still remains probably the strongest and the most moving of all the artifacts that I actually photographed and held.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, very surreal, I guess, too, Eddie, that here you are working in a concentration camp, which is now a memorial, but 74 years ago, sole purpose was to work people to death. And here I am holding something that belonged to a young child.
Yes. Now, Richard, you are highly successful. You've worked in TV, in film, even in product placement. You founded Australia's first product placement agency.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
How did this work evolve?
You know, it's been a journey. And I guess, as Plato says, the beginning is the most important part of the work. It's been a journey of many, many years. I've been in television. I've worked in marketing for a number of TV stations and Hollywood studios. Up until recently, I imported water from Europe. I brought Voss water to Australia. And I was actually looking for another project to do. And my wife actually said to me, Richard, I don't think Sydney needs another scotch or another tea. I think you should do something meaningful and fulfilling. And I've always loved photography, always enjoyed it as an art, as a medium, as a way of speaking, and the language and grammar of photography. And I guess it was like planted the seed with me. And then at the same time, we were going on a European holiday as a family last Christmas, 2018. And I have an interest in European history, World War II history. We were doing a tour of the concentration camp Sachsenhausen with a doctor of history, Dr. Robert Sommer, East German-born gentleman. And as I was talking to Robert about it, I said, Robert, there are many things on display, but I would imagine there are many things that are not on display. Mm. And he actually said, well, Richard, there are so many things that are not on display that I can get you access to. And then I guess over a space of 3 or 4 months, I came back home to Sydney and we were just workshopping a way that we could start to tell some stories about these victims of the Holocaust and Nazi persecution. And that's how it happened. And, you know, we got buy-in from both Ravensbrück and Sachsenhausen, and the German government were completely behind it. And they gave me, you know, unusual, unfiltered access to all these amazing archives. There were so many things in there. We filtered down the ones that we thought were most impactful. And it was a number of trips to Berlin and to both memorials, and they gave us the space and the time. And I guess that's how it sort of progressed. Really, it was for me just a personal project, being a child of Holocaust survivors, growing up in Australia, in Sydney, and always hearing about it from my parents. My late uncle was the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Elie Wiesel, who wrote the book Night. So it's always been in my family. My background is journalism and communications. So I guess it was a natural progression for me, one that I took quite late in life, but I'm so glad I'm on this journey now.
And Richard, what records were kept at the camps? Because, you know, many of us will have that image of the items which were stolen from the people as they were taken into the camps. So is it then the case that each one of those items would have actually been literally itemized and records kept?
Absolutely. The Germans kept records on everything. The moment you came into the camp, you were given a number. They only tattooed numbers on the people in Auschwitz. So you were given a number on your clothing. You wore that. You also wore, you know, what kind of prisoner you were, political, whether you were gay, whether you were Russian, whether you were Polish, all sorts of things. And then everything was taken from you. And the Germans were so efficient, they would actually give you a receipt that when you would leave the camp, you can take back your belongings, which of course was completely false and untrue. So everything was then catalogued and filed, particularly the person, what transport they arrived on, where they came from, and then what happened to them. Because you really were not written out of the camp as dead until you were basically cremated and your ashes were put into urns. There is an image I took of a top of an urn from a lady that came from, where did she come from? She came from The Hague and she arrived in 43. Simone Albrecht was her name. And then Simone died 9 months later. So they cremated her, wrote her name on the urn when she arrived, when she died, and then they called her family to come and collect the ashes. And only then were you considered dead.
It's a really horrific irony, isn't it, that this efficiency that led to mass murder beyond our imagining, it also led to you being able to trace the histories of these objects.
Yeah, I mean, I was working in a room not much larger than a little cubicle of an office with my camera, my lights, an assistant, and then Robert. And then Robert was literally accessing the database of the files because each artifact was brought to me from its storeroom, from its protective area with a tag on it. And then that tag corresponded to a reference on the system within the camp. And within that system were all the records of the person that when they arrived. It was quite phenomenal, actually. Quite phenomenal.
Can we talk about another photograph that I have to say particularly caught my eye as a musician? It's the photograph of the violin. Can you tell me the story behind this simple photograph of a violin and a bow?
Sure. It's a beautiful violin. You probably even know what it is. I think it was made in 1898, Stradivarius, and it belonged to a Jewish Austrian family. And then the lady, I can't remember her name. It may come to me. She came on a transport to Ravensbrück, the women's camp, from Austria. And then she was put to work. And then the Germans, being cultured and who enjoyed music, while at the same time they're executing people and starving them to death in the same place, were looking for musicians to join the orchestra of the camp to play music when transports would arrive into the camp and when the women would go to work at the Siemens factory, which was literally down the road from the camp as slave labourers to work at Siemens, where incidentally they were charged out at $1 by the SS to Siemens for day labour. And again, if you passed away, you had to bring your body back to the camp for roll call, and only then were you signed off as dead. But in any case, she arrived with her violin. She was Austrian, so she was considered a little bit a better class of a Jew than the others arriving from Poland and the Ukraine. And she had a skill of playing the violin. So she worked in the orchestra. But the beautiful thing was that because she could play the violin, she was able to save six other ladies who also had musical skills. Because by being in the violin, that means you were practicing, you were inside. So you weren't outside in the minus temperatures working when you had no clothing and you were not being fed. So your life expectancy grew significantly by being inside. So she really saved eight people, seven to eight people, by just having that skill set.
Yeah.
It's quite an amazing story.
Yes. Well, Richard, for me, you know, I played cello and viola, and from a very young age, us musicians, you know, we're taught to love our instruments and protect them virtually with our lives, actually. And here I see an instrument that was so loved, but also by the things and the that are missing and the things that are broken, it's clear that the instrument itself has been through some sort of extreme brutality. You know, there's no hair left on the bow, and the bow is broken in its most vulnerable spot at the tip and then taped back together. And the heart of the violin, which is the bridge that holds up the strings, that's been completely knocked out of position, so the instrument then doesn't sound at its optimum. You know, so as a musician, this photograph, this simple photograph, tells a massive story, and I have to say it's completely heartbreaking. Do you know what happened to the owner of the violin?
Yeah, she went back to Austria, rejoined the Austrian Philharmonic, and had an amazing career back as a violinist. And she passed away, I believe, in early 1990.
What responsibility do you feel by doing this work and putting it out into the world?
Look, for me, originally it was a personal journey, just something I was going to do that I felt I would like to do to honour my family that were in the camps, and to honour the millions and millions that were in the camps, the little bit that I could do. I had no idea at the time, last year when I was doing this, that it would become what it has become and where it has led me in my life now as a photographer, I guess. But originally it was about just, you know, conveying the prisoner's narrative and giving these people that can't speak for themselves anymore a sense of humanity and human dignity. When in reality, you know, when they were in the camps, it was nothing but humiliation and total contempt for human life. Mm. And for me, as a photographer, you know, I'm telling these people stories, individual stories, and using the language of photography to do that. And then having this unique access to be able to marry that narrative to their actual history, to who they were and what happened to them and their fate, allows these victims to speak with, you know, a collective voice, I would say.
Yeah.
And in so doing, I would imagine, would bring a sense of honesty and humility to that. And I also felt that by not taking photographs of, you know, gas chambers and, you know, gas tins, but actually taking photos of images and items that everyday people have, it kind of, you know, makes you connect with them on a different level, on a human level, like, oh my gosh, I had a teddy bear like that when I was a child, or my daughter or son has a teddy bear like that. And I think it connects you differently to the standard images that we've seen before. And, you know, people have asked me the same question, Eddie, you know, whether these images are timely with the rise of the alternate right globally. And I think so, yes. But when I was taking them, I don't really see, you know, left or right politically. I just see right and wrong. Mm. And what happened there was wrong. And what is still happening in the world is wrong. And I think we just need to be vigilant.
Yeah.
And
Richard, Primo Levi, with his memoir of Surviving the Holocaust, If This Is a Man, and also that extraordinary book, Moments of Reprieve, where he writes of singular moments of humanity in Auschwitz. We're fortunate to have writers like him and like your uncle, Elie Wiesel, who wrote the book Night, about his own experiences in Auschwitz. Mm. So do you see these photographs almost as a visual companion to those works?
I'd hate to compare these photographs to those works because they're just, you know, brilliant works on their own. I think it's just, you know, I it's a good question, Eddie. I think they could work side by side with them. I look at it more in relation to Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Mm, okay.
And by that I mean, you know, how do you overcome such tragedy and heartbreak, and when everything is stripped away from you, how do you survive another day? How do you move on? How do you grow through that? And that's how I try to work these images, is like, what happened to these people? How do you find growth through trauma? And many of them came to Australia, like my parents, and created brand new lives for themselves, and, you know, contributed to Australian society, and you know, had second and third generation children now growing up as Australians in this beautiful country of ours. And I think it's more about that aspect of it. And really, you know, my hope is that when people will see these images, I hope they will move them in some way, and that they'll reach them in some way, and maybe make people think about what's going on at the moment. Mm. And then if they can connect with them, and if they can then think whether it made, whether they worked in some respect and whether it changed their mind or perception about an idea or an event. And it might even move them enough to share what they've seen and maybe with other people and to talk about how they felt. That would be amazing. And that would be, you know, the message that I would really care about.
Thank you for coming in. Richard Weisel, the photographer behind the exhibition Objects from the Nazi Concentration Camps. It's shown in Sydney from September the 15th at the Central Synagogue in Bondi Junction in Sydney, and from the 21st of October at the Sydney Jewish Museum in Darlinghurst.